Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing on Bedford Place in Bloomsbury, WC1. One street east of Vera Crawford's killing. One street south of where the unfortunate Mr. Johnson's killer took a snooze. The same street as the arrest of Zachariah Buller. And a few houses from the feet which stank. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Built in 1805, Bedford Place consists of two rows of Georgian townhouses, with white stucco walls and black wrought iron railings on the ground floor, with brown brick and white sills on the three floors above. It's easy to get confused, as with every house looking identical, the neighbours' lives must resemble a bawdy sex farce from the 1960s. As several randy salesmen kiss their frumpy wives, dart next door to doink a saucy strumpet silly.
Oh, hello.
Only to realise that he's either boffed his wife, the vicar, a dog, or knowing this neighbourhood, a tub of avocado and hummus sashimi. On the night of Monday the 18th of May 1942, 33-year-old part-time prostitute Jean Stafford was waiting in her ground floor room at 3 Bedford Place for a man. As a good woman in a bad situation, she hoped that this potential husband would end her struggle and take away her misery. And although this expectant guest arrived, that night, he erased her pain by ending her life. My name is Michael. I am your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 245. Good Girl Gone. The death of Jean Stafford makes no sense at all when you look at her life. Her real name was Agnes Martin. Born on the 3rd of August 1909 in the village of Deepcar, a few miles north of Sheffield. Although she adopted several monikers, she never lost her strong Yorkshire accent. Raised in a working-class family of coal miners and quarrymen, Agnes, who preferred to be called Jean after the actress Jean Harlow, was the only step-sibling in this family of 12, so felt that she never belonged. Little is known of her upbringing, but growing to be a small but sturdy girl with pale skin, blue eyes and apple blossom cheeks. Her shyness endeared her to others. Her quietness meant she was rarely in trouble. And her sweetness attracted her to older men, who she liked, as she often sought a father figure. As the runt of the litter, after the death of her mother when she was just 15, Jean left the family home. For 8 years, as a young solitary girl, we know nothing about her life, except her work as a cook and a housemaid in Barnsley and Harrogate. But in 1932, when she was aged just 23, her life had changed forever. Having moved 70 miles east to Hull, Agnes Martin had become Jean Smith. A common name, it was all too easy to confuse with others, and for good reason. As being a single woman, earning a dishonest crust in a city where she wasn't known, she was cautioned twice for soliciting. As a sweet-faced girl with a kindly manner, she didn't have any convictions for prostitution. She didn't have any charges for drunkenness, as she rarely drank. She had never been to prison, as she didn't steal or cheat from her clients. In fact, they often came back, as she was good and honest. And although a solidly built girl, who many said could easily handle herself, she never got into fights and was rarely attacked. Later that year, having dyed her hair platinum blonde and being dressed in a faux leopard skin coat, Jean met 49-year-old retired sports writer James Stafford, also known as Jim. A quiet, unassuming sugar daddy, who many described as foolishly generous with his £3,000 inheritance, £250,000 today, who would lavish the lady who he loved to posh meals, nights out, and fancy clothes, treating her as a kept woman. On the 7th of February 1933, under the alias of Jean Smith, Agnes Martin technically became Jean Stafford, and they happily lived together in the Springbank district of Hull. Or at least they did, for a while. As although James would state, she had no sense of the value of money, he had a gambling addiction. He later said, "My wife was a strong woman, attractive, pleasant, exceedingly generous, and able to look after herself." So having got herself a job as a housemaid at the Angel Arms pub in Brixton, South London, with no bad blood between them, the last time he saw her alive was on Valentine's Day of 1938. But 4.5 years later, he identified her body on a cold slab of marble at Holborn Mortuary. By the outbreak of the Second World War, with a city in chaos, Jean earned a tiny wage as a tidy housemaid and a crafty cook in several public houses in the West End. And although she was given a bed to sleep in, with the Argyle and the Cooper Arms both being bombed, everything she owned was destroyed. Jobs were scarce, food was rationed, and with so many potential husbands called up to fight, the pickings were slim. On Saturday, the 18th of October 1941, carrying the few items that she still owned, Jean called at 3 Bedford Place, having seen a room to let sign. Greeted by Joseph Lamb, the 40-year-old warehouseman who lived in the basement, his evidence proved invaluable. And although the police stated he knows more about her than anyone, but denies being intimate with her, this wasn't exactly a revelation, as Joseph was gay. Having agreed to pay 30 shillings a week for a ground floor, back room, and a shared kitchenette and a bathroom with the other 12 tenants, Joseph told the police she introduced a tall man, saying, "This is my friend. He's helping me pay the rent." She never said his name, but he was described as late 40s to 50s, dark hair, deep-set eyes, swarthy and broad, with a Jewish nose and a deep voice. For Jean, life at 3 Bedford Place was good. Owned by Mrs. Hornheap, who she rarely saw, it was managed by Edith O'Connell, the housekeeper, with Joseph keeping an eye on things in the evenings and every Sunday when Edith wasn't there. As a private person who spent most of her time alone in her room, Jean regularly received men friends. Occasionally, she got some post. And a few times a week, on the communal telephone in the hallway, she received a call. With the ground floor split into 3 rooms, Jean's was barely big enough for a single bed, a sofa, a dressing table, a gas fire, a lamp. And with so few clothes in the wardrobe, the tenants often saw her wearing just a thin frock. Or according to Joseph, "I've seen her in bed, sitting up. She was bare." As a quiet girl, who often sat alone, knitting in front of the fire. Although she only spoke in passing to the other tenants, who were always polite, she got on best with Joseph. "As hardly a day went by without her popping her head into my room," he would say. And to help each other out, as a good cook, she often made his meals, which he left in the cupboard for when he returned home from work. But not every tenant in the house was as pleasant. Joseph said, "Jean told me she'd asked Mr. Pollard, an ex-army captain who was living in the adjoining room, to set a mousetrap. And she was terrified of the mice which scuttled from the kitchen. Having done so, he had tried to fondle her. As being an alcoholic who'd lost his career and his family, having been convicted of buggery, George Pollard was a sex pest, but there was no proof that he had killed her." In the ensuing investigation, the police examined the lives of a wealth of suspects. Especially as by the Christmas of 1941, with the tall man having left her following a tiff, Jean had returned to selling sex. Joseph said, "I didn't know that she was a prostitute." As she kept her life private, rarely drank, shuttled her clients from the door to her room in silence, and she tried to keep the sex as quiet as possible. But detectives were able to track down several of her clients. In keeping with her good-natured way, her sex work wasn't sleazy and cheap, but innocent and sweet. Private Ronald Ward of the Royal Montreal Regiment said,
"On the 18th of January 1942, at 10 p.m, outside of the Lion's Corner House tea room in Piccadilly,
where she regularly solicited,
she asked me if I'd like to go home with her. I asked how much. She said £1.10, and I said okay.
At roughly £100 today, she charged more than most. But being sweet, she reassured the timid ones. She cheated no one. And knowing that many men simply miss their girlfriends, instead of just sex, she gave these boys what they needed." Having walked back to 3 Bedford Place, Jean asked Ronald to be as quiet as possible as they entered the hallway. And having unlocked the door to her small room, instead of undressing, she made him a meal. With it being wartime, everyone was struggling. So as part of her good nature, they sat in front of the gas fire getting warm, eating toast and jam, supping a nice cup of tea, and having a good old natter. It was part of who she was. And if she could convince him to stay over for a little bit extra, all the better. She stripped off all of her clothes, all except her stockings, although she seemed very shy, Ronald said. We had sex twice, albeit quietly, and then we went to sleep. Another client was 42-year-old Coleman Fellerman, who first met her in October 1941, and like many, he became a friend. I agreed to go back with Jean. She was in no hurry. In fact, had she not solicited me, I shouldn't have thought that she was a prostitute. And as she often did, she made him food. They chatted, had sex, and with him being in catering, she asked if he could get her a job as a cook. 2 weeks later, he interviewed her for a job in Gosport. And although he said, "Let me know how you get on," he never heard from her again. At the time of her death, he was at his lodgings in Morden. A third client, Gunnar Alexander Campbell of the Canadian Artillery, regularly wrote her letters as he loved that she mothered him. First meeting on the 7th of March 1942, he bought her gifts and paid to stay across most of the weekends in March and April, having telephoned her first. He last saw her alive on the 8th of May 1942, but 10 days later, when she was murdered, he was stationed at Sittingbourne in Kent. And a fourth client, whose ration book was found in her room, having given it to her as a gift, as I saw that she had hardly any food in her cupboard, was Private Ulf Hupp, a Norwegian ski instructor whose movements on the night of the murder were accounted for by several witnesses at the Savoy Hotel. All four of those men were ruled out, which is not to say that she only ever had four clients, or that of the few people that she actually spoke to or may have met, that none of them were innocent. Weekly, Jean brought condoms from a vendor in Piccadilly Circus called Sidney Bloom. 6 years earlier, Sidney had been quizzed by the police over the murder of Soho prostitute Josephine Martin. And although an infamous RAF cadet picked up women at the Lion's Corner House tea room in Piccadilly in February 1942, by that May, having been found guilty, Gordon Frederick Cummings was already awaiting his execution. None of these men, her friends, or any of her family were suspected of being her murderer. But the police had narrowed it down to just three: the tall man, her caller, and Johnny. Breaking up with the tall man in Christmas 1941, being roughly 50, with deep-set eyes, swarthy skin and a deep voice, he would have been easy to spot, only after that date, he was never seen again. Johnny, whose real name she never divulged, was described as a dapper-looking cove in his mid-30s, 5'5" tall, with fair hair and a slight paunch. Having met him six times prior, Edith the housekeeper stated,
He was always polite, with a nice disposition. As just like all of these suspects, he hadn't threatened Jean. As she always chose her clients carefully, and she didn't associate with bad men. By the end of April 1942, having split up with Johnny for reasons unknown, Jean was struggling. Being close to broke, she sold her few possessions, a faux leopard skin coat and two handbags, at Jimmy's hairdressers on Charlotte Street, as well as the last of her best dresses, leaving her room almost empty. And with her usually large appetite stymied by a recurrent headache and earache, she wasn't well. In fact, since the 24th of April, up until the day of her death, she'd spent much of it in bed. Monday the 18th of May 1942 was her last day alive. Waking late, as far as we know, she was knitting for a few hours. She saw no one, which wasn't unusual. And with the few coins she had left, she shopped for bread and powdered milk. At 4:30 p.m, while out, Edith took a phone call for her, which went,
"Is Miss Stafford there?"
"No, she's out."
"Will she be back at 6?
I guess.
"Can you let her know? I'm in the Royal Flying Corps now. I'm a nephew of her father's brother."
And assuming that Jean knew who he was, as he didn't give it, she didn't take his name or his number. Edith said it was a local call, as the ring was long. It wasn't from a phone box, as she didn't hear the coins fall. And although she would confirm, it was something like Johnny's voice, but it was definitely not his. Being neither deep, light, nor with an accent, she didn't think that she'd spoken to him before. Every nephew of her father, her brothers, or her husband were accounted for. Every absentee from all the local RAF bases were questioned and ruled out. But with the caller using the term Royal Flying Corps, an archaic term for the Royal Air Force, the police felt that either this was a red herring or Edith had misheard. Either way, Jean read the message, and later its charred remains were found in the bin. The rest of that evening was as routine as any other. At 6 p.m, Joseph returned from work. He waved as he passed her room and said she was her usual self. In the kitchen cupboard, she'd prepared a meal of roast lamb, cauliflower, carrots and mashed potato. And although he returned the plate to her at 7 p.m, she'd barely eaten half of hers, having been sick for weeks. Sat in a blue and white flower pattern dress, she said that she was going out, but was waiting for a call first. So to pass the time, they chatted as they always did, and with them both smelling a very faint whiff of gas in her room. As Joseph was unable to detect the leak, they queried if this was the cause of her sickness. At 7 p.m, Kitty Jones, a ground floor tenant, saw her, stating she was wearing all of the jewellery she had, being a metal ring with a stone missing and a cheap wristwatch, which were later found on her body. By 7:15 p.m, Joseph left to meet his friend Mr. Claremont at the Fitzroy Tavern in Fitzrovia and the York Minster in Soho, being two bars frequented by gay men. And at 9 p.m, Kitty heard Jean welcome a man into her room, who she didn't see, but said they were on friendly terms,
and then Kitty left until 10 p.m. That left aircraftman Mark LeBlanc and George Hudden on the first floor listening to the radio. And on the ground floor, George Pollard said he was asleep. And with the partition walls being so thin that the tenants could hear each other breathe, from 9 p.m. till 10 p.m, when it was said her murder occurred, none of them heard a thing. At 9 a.m. sharp, Edith the housekeeper was greeted by Joseph on the doorstep as he sorted out the post and called out to Jean.
Love, you've got a letter.
Which, being a late sleeper, she ignored. But by 11:40 a.m, with her door still ajar and Jean having not moved an inch, seeing the blankets pulled up to her nose, which exposed her toes, as Joseph went to shake her awake, he felt that she was cold. Jean was dead. The room was as she had left it the night before, being neat, orderly and clean. With the drawers shut, the gas fire off, the lamp's shade on the floor suggesting she'd been knitting, the back window open to let a light breeze in, and her knickers and stockings neatly folded on the armchair beside the bed. And with a single cup of tea, half drank, and no other crockery, it looked as if she'd died alone in her sleep. Told of her headache, her earache, and seeing a single spot of blood on the inside of her left ear, with a corresponding stain on the pillow, divisional surgeon Dr. Gregg assumed it was natural, but ordered an autopsy to determine her cause of death. Whether a fever, or as was common, gas poisoning. It was a scene the police had witnessed many times before. An unexpected death, with no signs of a burglary, no hint of a struggle. And although cyanosis had left her pale skin a slightly swollen mix of blue and red hues, beyond the decomposition, there were no obvious cuts or bruises. No one had heard her scream. But that night, although no meal was cooked, nor cup of tea brewed, she'd had a client. Naked, except for a pink suspender belt and a black lace and silk bra. She had neatly folded the belt up to remove her knickers. The right cup of her bra had been pulled down, exposing her breast. And with a recently used condom, minus any semen, found under the bedside rug, it was clear that sex had taken place. What didn't make sense was her dress. As this blue and white flower pattern frock was the only one she had left. And yet, unlike her underwear, it was found behind her head, scrunched up and creased. It was a scene as ordinary as any of the detectives had investigated before. And yet, among its absence of evidence, lay something strange. As on the bedside dressing table, in a dark, ominous lump, was a clump of pubic hair, ripped out of the roots, which weren't Jean's. In the room, an unidentified set of fingerprints were found. But when examined, none of them matched any of her foreknown clients, nor any of her friends, her family, or any of the tenants at 3 Bedford Place. Neither did the clump of pubes. Described as a generous, good-natured girl, fond of life and without any enemies,
It made no sense for anyone to hate her so much that they would kill her.
She had no money, few clothes, no jewelry of any value, and anything she did have, she had either sold or shared with her clients.
As a quiet woman, she had no rivals, no stalkers, no issues with her family, and her ex-lovers weren't bad men with a grudge. In short, she was careful about her clients. She stuck to her regular routine. She rarely went out. She didn't cheat the men she solicited or dated. And she always treated them well, which is why they liked her.
No one had any reason to murder her. And yet they did.
Examined at Holborn Mortuary, an autopsy determined she had been rendered unconscious by a fist, which had fractured the left of her jaw. Although strong and fiery if she needed to be, Jean was strangled with her own dress, and unable to fight back, it only took a small amount of pressure to end her life.
On the 19th of June 1942, 4 weeks after her death, the St. Pancras coroner, Sir Bentley Purchase, concluded that Jean Stafford was murdered by person or persons unknown, and the case was closed. Neither the tall man, the caller, or Johnny were ever found, and no one was arrested on suspicion of her murder. As of today, it remains unsolved. And yet, on the 30th of May 1953, a decade after the murder, a 51-year-old man walked into a police station at Elizabeth Bay in Sydney, Australia. His name was Joseph Lamb, a former tenant at 3 Bedford Place, who police stated knows more about her than anyone, but denies being intimate with her. Interviewed, he said, "I believed I was under suspicion for some time. I suffered a nervous breakdown and eventually came to Australia." And although he'd initially denied knowing what this private woman did as a job, he'd later admit she was a high-class prostitute. That day, Joseph identified a man from a photograph published in the papers who he said was seen with Jean on subsequent occasions. This was a man who regularly used prostitutes. A man who had strange sexual perversions, like keeping the pubic hairs of his victims. And having murdered before, this West London serial killer had committed at least 8 murders of women from 1943 to 53, who he had rendered unconscious with a punch, some gas, then strangled and raped, but had mutilated. The man he identified as a regular client of Jean Stafford was John Reginald Christie.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
So there you go, folks. There you go. Ooh, excitement. Excitement. Ooh. I wonder if you like a nice cup of tea. He's back, or is he back? Oh, excitement. Oh. So that would be before he started, his killing spree, the ones that we dealt with earlier on. It was the year before. They've always said, oh, maybe he committed other murders. It's likely that he did. It's all slightly different, but there we go. Oh, excitement. Shall I make myself a little tea? Have I got time? It's 11 o'clock. It's 11:15 in the morning. It's nice out. I think I'll make myself a little tea, not a biggie. Let's not do a biggie tea. Let's just do a little tea, a little tiny one. Let's do that. I'm going to pop that in. I'm only going to have a little bit of splishy sploshy in there. I'm going to go to the coffee shop in a bit, have myself a nice little walk. Let's do a quaffy. Oh my God. There we go. I'm going to have one sugar because I deserve it. Well done, Michael. One sugar and some oat milk. Oh, life is good. And I did treat myself to some Mrs. Crimble's. Some Mrs. Crimble's macaroons, but they do vegan macaroons. Let's see how many calories are in there. Probably about per macaroon. 144. That's not actually too bad, actually. I was really expecting... I'll have a look because I'm sure the other ones are about 300. Maybe these are a bit better. I don't know. Anyway, so I hope you enjoyed that episode. That was every week I send off loads and loads of Freedom of Information requests to various archives to get some of these cases opened up because many of them are held for, like this case, this was held for more than 80 years. And I think because it's an unsolved case. So I always put in my Freedom of Information request and they always come back like a couple of weeks later, a couple of months, sometimes like a year and a half later sometimes. And they normally go, no, we're not releasing it. And this is the reason why. And I get it. But this one very quickly was approved. I think it's just been sitting there and no one's kind of FOI'd it. And it was on my list and they approved it. So, yeah, I hope you enjoyed that one. What else is going on in the world? Just had my 10-year boataversary. So I've been on my little boat, HMS Eva, for 10 years now, which is very exciting. What an interesting decade I've had. So to treat myself, I treated myself to some new bedding, which is not to say I've only had one set of bedding for 10 years, But I thought, yeah, let's do it for my boat-iversary. So that was great. So I got a new duvet and I got new soft brush cotton bedding. It's very plain, and I got it from Tesco's. It was cheap, but it's really bloody comfortable and really nice. Not that I've had a chance to kind of enjoy it, because obviously Eva's been on it all the time. And what I had to do was, you can't wake her up because she gets really angry. She's normally pissed as well. And she, you know, the bed's covered in vomit. So what I've learned to do is, do you know what that trick where you have a table and it's got crockery on it, and then you pull the sheet underneath and go, and you pull the sheet away and then none of the crockery spills? I've kind of learnt to do that, but with Eva. So you learn not to tip her over because she gets angry, but you learn not to spill the vomit everywhere as well. But apart from that, so that was all good. Thank you to a new patron supporter. Thank you to Bina Khalid. So that literally just came in today as I was writing this. So thank you, Bina. I'm going to send you your goodies ASAP. Also, thank you to Lucy Barr, who very kindly sent me a birthday treat rather than Murder Mile website, which I spent on Eva. Of course I did, because that's all I do. Spend all my money on Her Majesty. Her Majesty, HRH. The important one. I'm not worth anything. I think I treated myself to a penny sweet, and that was it. And Eva said that's all I deserve because I hadn't worked hard enough that day, which is true. Have I said welcome to Extra Mile, the unscripted, unedited bit? If maybe this is the first time you come into this, I don't know. But if it is. We do a little bit of waffle. We do some quiz questions shortly. I dive into some extra stuff on this case. And then you go about your lives and I go about mine. All good. So let's do some quiz questions, because I really want to tuck into those Mrs. Crimbles. I've already had three. Is the diet going well? I haven't been on my diet for like 3 months now, and it shows. I'm like Tweedledum and Tweedledee. In fact, I'm both of them. But I've got a holiday this summer. I decided not to go back on my diet until kind of end of March, because I thought if I go on my diet early January, by the time I go away in July, I'll have put the weight back on. So I thought, let's wait until April-ish. I've said April now. Then I can just power through the diet and look a little bit better on the beach. There we go. If Eva lets me, of course. So question number one, let's do this. In what year was 3 Bedford Place built? I'll give you that to the nearest decade. Question number two. What was the real name? What was Jean's real name?
Oh, your burpees.
Question number three. In what village was she born? I've done these all as very early questions, because sometimes when we do the quiz questions, sometimes I can't answer things in the extra mile bit because I'm going, oh, I can't answer that because it's a quiz question. So I've just done all the really early stuff now. Question number four, why did she choose the name Jean? Question number five, what had Jean been arrested for? Question number six, what colour was her hair? Question number seven, what did her husband do as a job before he retired? Question number eight, how much inheritance did her husband have? Question number nine, what day was the last? That almost makes sense. Question number nine, what was the last day that her husband said he saw her alive? I've retitled that question because I'd badly written it again. And question number 10, what was the name of the pub in Brixton where she worked? Ow. Oh, I've got a really sore big toe. I've had a sore big toe for ages. Right, let's dive into some extra stuff. That phone call. So Edith, the housekeeper who kind of ran the house, she said it happened at 4:30 p.m. This is the man that the police suspect of strongly committing the murder, although we can't. It's not like this man actually came into the house. But we know that she was waiting for someone. She said it happened around 4:30 p.m. He said, is Miss Stafford there? She said, no, she's gone to do some shopping. He said, will she be back in by 6? Edith said, I guess so. The man asked if he could leave a note. She said, I'll phone about 6. I'm in the Royal Flying Corps now, and I'm a nephew of her father's brother. As if to make it nice and complicated. I'm a nephew of her father's brother. I'm related to her stepsister's dog's flatmate's cousin. He didn't give his name and she didn't ask. She thought that he said mentioned Tring and that the RAF base. The police actually did research over there. The nearest RAF base to Tring was actually Cheddington. Police checked who was absent from that night. There were 80 men who were absent that night. That's because they were on official leave. 10 admitting to being in London. They couldn't check all the leave chits because they were all destroyed as the man returned back, but they did a kind of a proper check as much as they could. And they couldn't actually find any soldiers who were kind of AWOL at that time either. Edith said, I've used this in the episode, it was a long call, it was a long ring. So back in the 1940s, if it was a long ring, it was a local call. If it was a short ring, it was a long call. She knew it didn't come from a phone box because normally at that point, I still remember these from the 80s and being confused by them, where you went into a phone box, you put your money in, you wouldn't pay for the call until the other person picked up the call, and then you'd have to press button A. And button A would make your calls go in. So if it was a payphone, you'd hear nothing. Then you'd hear like a beep, 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 beep. And then you'd hear the k-k, and the money would go through and eventually you'd get your call. It always took a couple of seconds. And she said it didn't come through an operator either. It looked like it was a landline call. She said it was something like Johnny's voice, but it definitely wasn't his. Unfortunately, in none of the statements does she say what Johnny's voice sounded like. But apparently it wasn't accented. The note that she left was left in a waste paper basket. She said it was slightly burnt at one end, and in the bin was a John Player special cigarette butt. What else have we got? 7 o'clock, as mentioned. She did as she always did. You know, she made a little meal for Joseph. They didn't eat together. They ate in their separate rooms. But she would always leave it in the kind of cupboard for him. He came in at 7 o'clock to say thank you very much and to give her the plate back because it was her plate. He asked her if the caller was... she said she was sitting there waiting for a call. He asked if the caller was expected for dinner and she said, no, I'll meet him out. She was sitting there, as mentioned, in her clothing, the blue and white flower patterned dress. It's kind of Mayish, so she's not kind of wearing lots of clothes. She doesn't have to because the weather was quite good that day. Hence, the window was slightly open, although it's interesting that she had 5 layers of blankets on top of her. What else we got? As mentioned, she pretty much didn't have any jewellery left. She hadn't got a wedding ring anymore. So the little metal ring with the stone missing, that was on her third finger of her left hand, which is not the wedding finger. And she had a small wristlet watch. All of them were cheap. All of them were on her body afterwards. Kitty, who we don't hear really much about, to be honest, she's not there that much. I think she was a clerkroom attendant at Victoria Station. So if she was there 30 years later, she would have been the one dealing with the body that we dealt with in Meticulous. Kitty was there. She left at 9 p.m. She came back at 10 p.m. So she was away during the window when the murder is said to have occurred. That's according to Sir Bernard Spilsbury, who did the autopsy. And he said, based on the timeline, it was around 9 p.m. till 10 p.m. But don't forget, that can be wrong. Joseph left at 7:15 p.m. He went to Fitzroy Tavern on Charlotte Street to meet his friend Mr. Claremont, and they went to the York Minster. As we know, both of these pubs are kind of known gay establishments in the 1940s. They went and fed the ducks, and then they went to Irish House in Piccadilly till about 10:30, and then they walked home, arriving back at 11. Now, we know this definitely happened because we've got Marge, the landlord's daughter, at the York Minster. She was talking to him. He came back with Mr. Claremont, and I've got the... Oh, that sounds like the fuel boat. I could have done with that. He came back, and the two guys who were underneath... leading aircraftmen Hudden and LeBlanc from the Royal Canadian Air Force. Because LeBlanc lived on the first floor, him and Hudden had actually said goodbye to each other for the day. And just as Hudden was coming out, he bumped into Joseph. And I think because all gay men. They were chatting to each other outside, so just about 11 o'clock. And then Joseph said, oh, do you know, I've got... why don't we come into my basement? We'll have a chat and some drinks. So, George Reginald Pollard, who was the sex pest, well, I'll dive into that in a second. He said around 10 p.m., 11 p.m, he heard foreign voices. Now, we know what the foreign voices were. This was the Canadians and Joseph and his friend, Mr. Clermont. They were down in the basement and they were talking to each other in French. Because don't forget, these guys are Canadian. But also Joseph spoke French as well. So that's what it was. And then they left at 11 o'clock. So pretty much everyone is accounted for, except for George Reginald Pollard, who's in the room next door to Jean's. Now, he, in 1932 at Dorset Assizes, he was charged with 8 months for gross indecency, the original charge being buggery. He was in the house from 7:30 p.m. He said he didn't hear Jean, but noticed there was a light on in her room. As the light shined through the kitchenette, as I mentioned, there was partition walls. These are kind of, as they did in this era, to make a lot of money, and they still kind of do it in a way today. If you've got a big Georgian house and the rooms are huge, what they do is separate the rooms into three with very thin partition walls, sometimes with glass panels at the top to let a little bit of light through, because some of these rooms won't have windows at all, and that way they can make a lot of money out of few people. So he was in one of these rooms next to Jean's. He said he didn't hear anything. He could hear the voices downstairs. The walls were incredibly thin. With regards to his indecency charge, he was married. He had children. It looks like while he was down in Weymouth, I've got the report somewhere. It looks like he got really, really drunk with a seaman, and it looks like they engaged in a little bit of sex. So that's what it seems to be. But that kind of ended all his career. He was captain in the army and he kind of really messed up his career, and he never really saw his family after that. So everything kind of disappeared. Joseph Lamb returned at 11 p.m. What else have we got? And then he pretty much, after the party had finished, he went downstairs to bed. He said he didn't notice whether the light was on, although there was the frosted window in the kitchenette. There was a crack at the bottom of the door that she often put kind of a duster in it, because the mice kept coming through the kitchen and her bedroom, which really annoyed her. She kind of really hated mice. And he said that was in place. In the morning, the door was slightly ajar, but, you know, it could have slightly come ajar by itself. Maybe it wasn't fully locked. But as mentioned in the story, it seems as if everything was kind of normal. It looks, for the police when they turned up, as if she'd just gone to bed by herself. In fact, even Dr. Gregg, who was the divisional police surgeon who determined her life was extinct, said she had advanced rigor mortis. He put death between 8 p.m. and 9 p.m. the night before. He'd heard from Joseph and the other members of the flat that she'd been ill for quite some time, a good couple of weeks, and seeing the spot on the left ear and on the pillow, there were no obvious signs of violence, so he recommended an autopsy just to confirm what it was. He thought it was some kind of blood clot or something, but with her face having quite a lot of cyanosis because of the decomposition, therefore they could, and also, as mentioned in the episode, she was strangled quite lightly because she was already unconscious. If she was struggling, whoever was killing her would have had to use a lot of force. But because she was already unconscious, pretty much he'd tried to strangle her with the... this is what the police worked out. He tried to strangle her with her dress, but then he decided to use his hand. Although there was no real obvious signs of fingerprints on that. In some cases, you can kind of work out what size the man is but by the size of his hand, but there wasn't enough bruising to be able to work that out. No signs of struggle in the room, no signs of disorder, nothing seemed to have been taken. This was based on Joseph, who kind of knew what she had in the room, and she did not have much. There was no ash in the ashtrays, even though she smoked. There were no glasses or cups used except the one that she used. She'd been clearly been sitting by the fire. He remembers seeing her sitting by the fire, knitting, waiting for the call at about 7 p.m. So that all makes sense. The curtains were closed, because don't forget, we're still in a blackout. So you've got the big, heavy blackout curtains there, but the window was open. On the ledge, he saw a bottle of milk and a jug containing parsley on the flat roof outside. So she could have left it open, or that could have been a route of which her killer may have escaped, or he could have gone out through the front door. We don't know. We really don't know that. What else have we got? Fingernails. There was no fight, as mentioned, but even if there had been a fight, because she had a habit of biting down her nails, her fingernails were incredibly short. So there would be nothing underneath her fingernails. The condom was found. She had three French letters, as they call them, three condoms, one of which was empty. The top had been torn off and was found under the rug near the bed. So someone clearly put it there. They deliberately tried to hide the condom, which is interesting. If you've just had sex with a woman and then you try and kill her, why not take the condom with you? Why hide it in the room? It doesn't make sense. On the dressing table, there were 17 different articles. So things like a hairbrush and kind of toiletries and stuff like that, as well as a bunch of hair, which is pubic hair. This definitely wasn't jeans. It was darker in colour, and it was quite a quantity of pubic hair, it was said. Now, there could be two things here. If you go back to Meticulous, as mentioned in there, the guy who was the killer, I can't remember his name off the top of my head. See, when I'm not working on cases, everything goes out of my head. Because he was Latvian, he kept pubic hairs of his former lovers. And I did a little research on this, and apparently this is a Latvian thing, that if you love someone, you keep like a locket of their pubic hairs. So maybe this was that. But the police don't think it was. The police think it was some kind of anger happened at some point. It doesn't make sense what the police says. They did. Let me see if I've got it here. This is what the police said. There must have been a sudden surge of anger, and Mrs. Stafford pulled out the pubic hairs. Then the man struck a blow that fractured her jaw and knocked her unconscious. He picked her up and placed her on the bed, and realizing that she knew him and because of her temper would avenge herself, the man decided not to take the chance of being traced for murder. No one knew his particulars and no one saw him in the house. He twisted up the frock and tied it around her throat, but as there were no marks at the back of the neck, it is probable that he gripped her throat with his right hand and held it until she was dead. The French letter was then torn off and slipped onto the carpet. The man then awaited for darkness and slipped out of the house unobserved. See, the way that the body is on the bed, the way that she's neatly laid out, the way that she's folded her stockings up, the way that kind of one breast is partially exposed. And they said that the way the body was positioned was quite neat. It kind of more suggests that she kind of willingly lying there, that she was undressing, as the other clients have said, she'd undress and then she'd get into bed. It doesn't make sense that he would strike a blow with her and then he'd carry her nicely over to the bed and then place her down and she's still conscious, and then he'd go, oh, you've just realized that you know me, oh, I need to strangle you. There's just too many things that just don't make sense there. It makes more sense that someone had an angry sexual moment of some kind, you know. Like with kind of Blackout Ripper, you know, the choice of killing someone or letting them live is kind of really dependent on something as simple as whether she says something to him that he dislikes or something. Do you know, we're dealing with those kind of assholes here, so it could be. What else have we got? Police investigation was, they did as good as they could, but they found quite a few of the possible suspects, and we've dived into those into the episode. I didn't do all of their statements. If you're a patron subscriber, you will have access tonight to Bad Nanometers, of which I always read out statements in full, and people seem to be enjoying those. It gives you a fuller insight into things, and it gives us a chance to kind of really engage with stuff. So if you're a patron subscriber, for as little as I think it's £2 a month, you can enjoy that every week. That could be a little treat for you. Police report says it was known to that she was awaiting a visitor. She had very little money. So the police didn't think it was a robbery. It didn't seem like it was a sexually motivated attack. They'd had sex, but there didn't seem to be any sexual violence. There didn't seem to be any kind of violence in total. No one had kind of turned up deliberately with anything to kill her. It's not that they turned up with, you know, stockings to strangle her. They'd used her dress, so it was kind of a spur of the moment thing. But as mentioned, of the three suspects that they were looking for, the tall man they couldn't find, Johnny they couldn't find, and the other one as well, the caller. They still don't know who the caller is, and that will never be found. They searched all of the taxi drivers and the night workers in the area. They spoke to restaurants. They knew, because she worked in pubs and stuff, they checked pubs, they checked bakeries to find out any more about her. It was just couldn't find anything. In her room, they found various photographs, so they used those photographs to try and track down who she was and where she was from, because don't forget, she's still using a kind of an alias really here. And there was a fingerprint found which didn't belong to anyone known. This was actually found on the enamel commode. Ooh, so someone clearly had a plop. And in there also was a New Year's card from Johnny to Jean. So that's how they knew most of these people, because she kept all these different things, like the kind of the ration card from the Norwegian guy, or the the letters. When Joseph said to her after she died, "Oh, love, you've got a letter." That was actually a letter from Alexander Campbell. So the police were able to track him down. Ronald Ward had left his details so she could come and see him. We got the interview letter from Coleman. So, you know, it was all there. It was all there. But we really don't know much about these people. Tall man, as I've put pretty much everything I can, 48 to 52, 6'2" tall, dark hair, deep set eyes, swarthy complexion, square jaw, Jewish nose, broad shoulders, athletic build, and spoke with a deep voice. Never seen again, so we don't know much about him. Johnny was said to be 35 to 40, 5'5 to 5'6, clean shaven, dark complexion. He owns a car and he's believed to be a bookmaker, i.e. gambler. What else we got? I think that was about right. Edith had seen him 6 to 7 times, so she kind of knew his face and she knew his voice. It was also said that Johnny was said to have a job doing research for the government, and that his job was hush hush, although we don't know whether this is actually true at all. The caller is pretty much unknown. Clarence, her brother, had spoken to her a few times in the kind of the years before. Jean sometimes came to visit him and his wife in Guildford. He said he didn't know what she did, but she never mentioned about being threatened by anyone. She didn't seem upset. She just seemed to be someone who enjoyed life. She intended to have a good time while she was alive, which was one of her statements. And it may seem obvious, it may seem a little bit ominous, but let's not forget, this is wartime, everyone's surrounded by the Blitz, so people are just happy just to be alive. Sir Bernard Spilsby conducted the autopsy at Holborn Mortuary. She'd been dead for 12 hours by that point. There was a fracture on the left-hand side of the jaw, just below the ear, but death had occurred 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. due to strangulation. James Stafford, her husband, as mentioned in the episode, identified the body at Holborn Mortuary. So now everyone's probably gone, and the people who don't listen to Extra Mile, I'm going to do you a little favour here. So let's go back to the Christie connection. So here we go. This was actually a letter that was near the start of the file, and I started reading it. I thought, oh, that's really interesting. But then suddenly I was like, maybe not. So a letter was dated from Joseph Lamb in Australia on 30th of May 1953. Now, he'd already moved to Elizabeth Bay in Australia by that point. John Reginald Christie was arrested 31st of March 1953, and his photo was all over the newspapers by that point. So he actually turned up at the local police station there. Local police station got in touch with Scotland Yard. And it was interesting. Joseph wouldn't give a statement, but he was happy for the police to give his information to Scotland Yard, which was really weird. You would think he would be happy to sit down and give a statement. So by that point, he was about 50 years old. He called the police and alleged that he had identified the man who was seen with Jean Stafford on subsequent occasions from a photograph published in the newspaper as Christie. He suggested Christie might have been responsible for the murder. At the time of that letter, Christie had been arraigned already. And although the police had spoken to the Director of Public Prosecutions, because this was already going forward as a criminal trial, they didn't want to upset that criminal trial by questioning him about this. So Christie was never questioned about the murder of Jean Stafford at all. It kind of makes sense. You don't want to fuck up a court case that's going well with something that may not even exist. When asked why he didn't mention... Asked why Joseph didn't mention about Christie in his original statement, he said he didn't see the significance of it until now. Joseph Lamb refused to make any statement in connection with this matter and asked about his whereabouts in this country. And he asked that his whereabouts in this country be kept confidential from the police. As mentioned, he felt that he was under suspicion of her murder. He'd have had a nervous breakdown and then he fled to Australia, where he could start a new life. So police started looking at the details of this. At the time of the murder, John Christie was serving as a Metropolitan Police's War Reservist on Harrow Road, as we know. They checked the duty log, and it shows that he was on sick leave from the 15th to the 26th of October 1941, which would cover the alleged visit if he was coming to town, which, do you know what? Even though all of the ladies were murdered in and around in his room that we know of, we know he visited other prostitutes. If we go back to those episodes, we know that he picked up prostitutes in pubs, and we know that he visited other locations, other brothels with prostitutes. So that covers the alleged phone call. So the phone call, what I'm making reference to, is when Jean first went to 3 Bedford Place with the tall man. Now, we know he isn't the tall man, and we will come onto that in a second. Because this is the thing, that Joseph, who introduced her into the house, said, this guy was kind of 48 to 55, which is right. That's about Christie's age. 6'2", well, he's 5 inches shorter than that. Dark hair, he doesn't have any, he almost has almost no hair. Deep set eyes, yep, we can go with that. Swarthy complexion, no, he's a pasty motherfucker. Square face, no. Long. Jewish nose, no. Broad shoulders, no. Athletic build, definitely not. Spoke in a deep voice, absolutely not. As we know, he had a kind of a whisper. Even the police would say that. Which is not to say that he didn't get confused, that the man who turned up with her when she first moved into 3 Bedford Place, the person who was known as the tall man, maybe that is, but maybe he got confused, and maybe she was seen with Christie on other dates. Now, the police did look, they went to go and see his War Reserve records to see when he was working on the night of the 18th and 19th of May 1942, which is the day of the murder. Unfortunately, they were not available. They'd been lost during the Blitz. So, could be Christie, might not be Christie. Or, as the police would say, there was no evidence that Jean Stafford was murdered by John Christie. Of course, it is assumed that John Christie murdered many more women. He regularly visited prostitutes in the West End and the city. Most of these women were murdered in his home. But if you look at the connections, there are things there. Do you know, he does pick on vulnerable women. He does have a tendency to kind of punch them first and then strangle them. He, in some cases, does use gas to strangle them, domestic gas, before they added sulfur into it to start making people be sick. So it's possible. This was kind of something that I was going to save as an end thing where I thought I'd save this for you guys, but for me, I think this is kind of interesting. It could be John Christie. I don't think he's the tall man. I don't think he's there. I don't think he's Johnny either, because he's the wrong age and he looks entirely wrong. I don't think he's the caller either, because Edith would have said he had a quiet whisper, a raspy voice, and she doesn't say that. I don't think it's any of those three men. Could he be a potential client? I think so. There's loads of prostitutes about, and there's a lot of connections in here that we could make, but there's a lot of connections that we can make to other people as well, so he might not be. But it's interesting that Joseph Lamb would kind of come forward with this a year later. So maybe, having had his breakdown, maybe it was coming up to the, it was the anniversary, it happened, the 10-year anniversary. Actually, no, it's the 11-year anniversary. So he's starting to break. He saw Christie in the papers. Maybe he connected the dots. Maybe this is the truth, or maybe this is a lie, a kind of an alibi to get Joseph away from this. Although I don't think Joseph has anything to do with it. I think he's just a nice guy. As mentioned, he's gay, but that doesn't mean, he's not bisexual. It's just not mentioned there. In a lot of these police reports from the 40s, they just say gay. They don't say bisexual. So, could be one or the other. Could be both. We don't know. He could have had love for her. He could have been jealous about something. I don't think it is him at all. And could it be Christie? I don't know. I really don't know. But it's just interesting that around that point that this guy would go, oh, it's definitely Christie. I definitely saw her with him on several occasions. And we know that he did visit prostitutes on many occasions. So could be Christie, might not be Christie. Could be Joseph Lamb, might not be Joseph Lamb. Could be George Pollard, the guy who lived next door, might not be George Pollard the next door. So we don't know. So this is why I deliberately at the start of this episode so didn't say it's unsolved, because I knew people would go, oh, God, I don't like unsolved. So anyway, that was a long extra mile. I'm sorry about that, but I think we needed it for the end. Whew. Let's do the quiz questions, and then I can FRO down to the coffee shop. Right, here's the quiz questions. In what year was 3 Bedford Place built? I'll give you to the nearest decade. It was 1805. So if you're within 10 years of that, I'll give you that. Question number 2, what was Jean's real name at birth? It was Agnes Martin. Question number 3, in what village was she born? Deep Car. Question number 4. Why did she choose the name Jean? It was after the film star Jean Harlow. Question number 5. What had Jean been arrested for? It's a trick question. Nothing. She'd never been arrested for anything, but she was cautioned for soliciting, which is not an arrest. Question number 6. What colour was her hair? It was platinum blonde. Question number 7, what did her husband do as a job before he retired? He was a sports writer. Question number 8, how much inheritance did her husband have? It was £3,000, which is £250,000 today. Question number 9, what day did her husband last see her alive? It was Valentine's Day 1938. And what was the name of the pub in Brixton where she worked? It was the Angel Arms. So I hope you enjoyed that, folks. Ooh, that was an interesting one. I haven't quite decided what next week's episode is. I've researched loads. I just haven't decided which one to put in. But then again, this one wasn't meant to be here. But because I found it in the archives, I was like, I'm definitely going to do this one. And I'm glad that I did. So anyway, thank you very much, folks. I hope you all enjoyed that. Have yourself a good day. I'm going to have a coffee and a Mrs. Crimble's. So stay safe. Be good. Lots of love.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.